The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Up on Taconic, a recurring podcast that explores the world of Taconic High School from students, staff, school programs, and all of the things that happen here each day. Welcome to Up on Taconic. My name is Aiden. I will be your host for today. I am here joined by my friends Dalton and Avery. Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Hello.
Hello.
All right. We have got quite the show planned ahead of us, so it's not dilly-dally any longer. Let's get right into it.
Coming to a theater near you, The Interview.
Hello, Officer DeGraffenry.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. So my first question for you is, what led to you to become an officer?
Well, I became a police officer, honestly, because growing up, there were no police officers that looked like me, meaning there were no African-American women on the police force. So that was ultimately why I wanted to be a police officer, because I wanted to see more police officers that looked like me. And I also grew up in a time where we had really strong bonds and connections with police officers. So I got to spend a lot of time with DARE and Cops for Kids and different programs with the police officers. So I also just think spending time with the different officers in the community was another reason to push me to become a police officer too.
What training did you have to go through to become an officer?
In order to be a police officer in Massachusetts, you have to do 6 months of police academy. And after you do 6 months of police academy, then throughout your career, like every year, we still recertify on something as simple as CPR, first aid, we first responders, our firearms. We recertify on everything, taser, pepper spray, our baton training. So even though after we do the 6 months of academy, we are recertified every single year for all of our gear.
What were you before you became an officer?
Before I became a police officer, I was a bartender. I bartended for many years, and I worked security for BCC.
Was it hard at BCC?
It wasn't hard. I worked overnights. It was just, I don't know, that campus was kind of creepy and scary at night. You have to go through the different buildings and stuff, so I mean, I'm not really afraid of the dark like that, but I think those old buildings, I don't know, it was creepy.
How do you handle stressful situations as being an officer?
A lot of times, sometimes I just have to take a step back and like slow things down for myself so that I'm able to process it better. Taking a step back for me, especially if I'm going into a situation that I already know is going to be stressful, even just taking like that second before I get out of my cruiser, if I'm working patrol, or even if I'm here at school and I know like I have to run somewhere, just to take that quick second to just like breathe and just breathe in and just breathe out to decompress really quick, that's something that I've learned to do and that helps me.
What goes through your head if a bad situation is occurring?
How can I make sure that, first, the public is safe? That's my number one goal, is whoever I'm there to protect has to be safe. And then second is making sure that I'm safe and whoever else, whatever other first responders are there, whether it's another police officer, whether it's fire, whether it's EMT. But first and foremost is the public, then come the first responders and making sure that I'm okay.
What advice would you give to young people on interacting with police?
We're not all bad. I've had bad interactions with police officers. I mean, I've had bad interactions with police officers as a police officer. I feel like a lot of young people, because they've had bad experiences with police officers, that maybe they have that bad taste and they're just like, this is how one is, so this is how they all are. So just give us a chance, because we're not all that bad. Give us a chance.
What has been your most memorable experience on duty?
I would have to say just I really enjoy working in the community. Like when we get to do fun stuff. Like in the summertime, I drive around the ice cream truck and give out ice cream. I'll work the Pride Parade. I'll work First Friday. I love being around the community. And also, I honestly like being in the school. I like being around younger people and the youth. I think that it's just really important for them to have someone positive that is of some kind of authority figure, but in a positive way and not so much like the authority way.
Is there a story or lesson from your career that stands out to you?
Not so much a story. A lesson, I would have to say, a lesson for me would just, you know, take it one day at a time. And every situation is, it's not the same. Even if you go to the same house five times, it's not the same. But I take my job day by day, and one of the biggest lessons is treat people with respect. I've learned that as long as I give respect, they'll give me respect back. I was raised not to disrespect anyone and to just treat people respectfully. I treat people how I want to be treated.
My last question for you is, what advice would you give to somebody that wants to be in the same job you are, like a police officer or a resource officer?
I would tell them that it is not the easiest job. It is tough. It's wearing, but it's very rewarding. It is. It's very rewarding. It's not for the faintest of hearts. You are going to miss some birthdays. You will miss holidays. You'll work long hours. You'll be stuck at work. But it's very rewarding. Once you figure out where you want to be and what you want to do in this career, it's very rewarding.
I want to thank Officer DeGraffenreef for coming here today and talking with me about and giving us some experience on what her job is. And we will return back. Thank you, and this was The Interview.
Coming to a theater near you. The Interview.
Today we'll be discussing Movember, what it is, the work it does, and how it supports students dealing with mental health changes. Hello, Coach Capeless.
Hello, Julian.
Hello, Hunter.
How's it going?
So my first question for both of you is, what is Movember?
Well, so I'll answer initially the first part. Just on a broad scale, Movember is the leading charity for men's health. And their three main target areas are prostate cancer, testicular cancer, and mental health and suicide prevention.
Its goal is to raise funds and awareness for men's health. It encourages men to live healthier, longer lives.
And here at Taconic, we have a Movember club, and our main focus has been mental health and suicide prevention to help to try to break the stigma around mental health.
Okay, how did Movember start?
Well, Movember was started in 2003 in Australia. And we started our club here a few years ago. We had a couple students that were doing an a civics project. They wanted to talk about men's mental health. And at the same time, I was getting started as becoming a community ambassador for Movember. So we came up with the idea to start a club. And then we had already been doing a walkathon. So we combined the two ideas and put it all together.
Movember started, like you said, in 2003 in Melbourne, Australia. It's reached out to the U.S. It's expanded across, I think, 23 countries now. So more than that, way more than that. But basically it started with two guys in a bar, and they said they wanted to talk about men's mental health and make change, and grew from there. They inspired, and now it's reached over across the world.
What is the mission of Movember?
So the mission of Movember is to help to make men more aware of health problems that affect men, and to get men on board about reaching out for help and advocating for themselves in a health setting, and especially for mental health. Now there's been a big push to again to help to break the stigma, especially for men. Because men are more likely to go to negative things to help to cope with their mental health, and they're less likely to seek help from a professional, even if they really need it. And women do a better job of advocating for themselves and being there for each other and just being open with their emotions. And I think it's been a big turn in the newer, younger generation. Has been a lot more open towards their own mental health and their struggles and just being there for each other. Because I know that in the past it was a lot harder, and men looked at it as they had to do it on their own, and they were looked at as weak if they thought that they needed help. And so we're helping to spread the mission of Movember, which is just to advocate for yourself and just make healthy choices, and just to be conscious of how your health affects everything around you.
For sure. Like, specifically their slogan, to change the face of men's health by raising awareness and all that. Here at Taconic, I think we do it a lot differently than they do at Movember. We have a club where we raise specifically on, like, mental health. So every morning at 7 a.m., we meet up, you know, we have donuts, we talk. I think we just get a community going. We try to get more people to join. Some mornings we do runs. It just depends. But I think the mission is just to raise awareness and just build a community where we can all talk.
My next question is, why is growing a mustache part of the Movember campaign?
So it's a it's a chance to start a conversation. So a lot of times a mustache, whether it's a great mustache or a mustache that might need a little bit of work, either way, it's going to be a great conversation starter. So someone might say, hey, what's up with the mustache? What are you doing? And then it gives you a chance to explain why you're doing it and to tell them that you're helping to change the face of men's health by growing out your mustache.
Definitely. I know Coach Capeless definitely rocks a mustache in Movember. Curls it and everything. So I think it's definitely just a conversation starter. Definitely gets people saying, oh, we got to stop with your mustache, and then you can get them going and talking, and it leads from there.
Yeah, sometimes I get a little bit of pushback from people that say that they can't grow a good mustache or their mustache isn't any good. And even a bad mustache is a great conversation starter. Some may argue it's an even better conversation starter, because someone's going to say, hey, what are you doing? What's up with that? And then it gives you a chance to explain why you're doing it. You're doing it for Movember, doing it to help to raise awareness for men's health and to help to open the conversation. Because then once somebody starts talking about your mustache, it gives you a chance to start talking about Movember, why it matters to you, and what you're doing about it.
What measurable impact has Movember had globally?
So they've raised over $1 billion since 2003, and that's, I think it's a little bit higher than $1 billion, but that's just an estimate. They've had like over 1,250 mental health projects where they've engaged people, raised awareness, did research, had community events, just everything in between. And it's very good. I think Cape can cover more.
Yeah, so Movember does a good job of helping to make you feel part of the mission. So as a community ambassador, I don't feel like I'm sharing somebody's message. I feel like I'm a part of sharing the message of men's health, especially men's mental health. And like Hunter touched on, it's Movember has funded over 1,250 projects in over 23 countries. So it was started out in 2003 in Australia, has really become a global impact where the funds that are being raised is making an impact all around the world.
How does Movember use donated funds?
Well, like we had just stated. So I'll give a couple examples of the projects that were funded in 2025. So one thing that was new was that Movember released the Real Face of Men's Health report. And this is a big report that was put together by Movember. So in the past, they helped to fund research that other people were doing. But this was the first time where they had their own researchers develop their own report to talk about different things that are going on within men's health. And then they've done a lot of work in the digital world and to help to talk about what is going on with men. I think a lot of times are more likely to latch on to something to be a part of a group. So sometimes they see something online that might not be the best thing to be a part of, but they latch onto it because they're looking for some sort of connection. And then it can be something where it's a really negative thing. So they've done a good job of researching what men do online and how they access their information to help to try to shift things to a more positive experience, especially with social media.
I think they do a good job of just providing support and like resources to like men of all ages, just like find their what they need. And if like they're struggling, I mean, their page offers so much, and I mean, whatever you need is on there, basically, I think.
So another thing that they funded was, it says, leveling up in mental health and esports. In late 2024, Movember announced a partnership with a juggernaut, Blast. Over the last 12 months, they worked together to reach tens of thousands of players and fans, promoting the importance of mental health and healthy communities. Another thing that they've done is getting young men to know thy nuts. So testicular cancer is the number one cancer among young men, but most guys don't know it. And the annual Know Thy Nuts campaign, held during Testicular Cancer Awareness Month in April, encourages young men to know their risk, know their nuts, and know what to do if something doesn't feel right down there.
So I wanted to touch down more on the testicular cancer part of what you said, Mr. Coach Capeless. So last year, I experienced testicular cancer. It was very sudden and unexpected. I went through a lot of mental health issues. I had to get a lot of treatments. I had to get checkups, which I'm still actively going through. And it was just a lot for my body, and it was a lot for, you know, my life and everything. But you, thankfully, were there for me, and you connected me with somebody that went through the same thing. This is more bouncing off of what Capeless said on how testicular cancer is not uncommon for men to get. It's very, I want to say usual, but
yeah. So it's the leading cancer for young men age 15 to 40. So I think what you were able to do was to help to allow people to understand that it is something that's affecting people. And because a lot of times you see studies and you see numbers and you think like, oh, well, that's not going to happen to me. Like, oh, I won't know anybody that's going to happen to. But when you really break it down, and then when you find out that somebody that you go to school with is dealing with this, then it helps to realize like, wow, this could impact me. This could impact people that I know. And I was fortunate enough to be able to be able to connect you with somebody that's a Movember ambassador that's also gone through it. And I know that the way that he attacked it was that he just tried to focus on his own personal health. And he was, he's a trainer. He's an athletic trainer and so a strength coach. So he works out a lot and he wanted to put his body in the best position to be able to fight the cancer and came out stronger on the other side. And I know that he was able, you guys were able to talk a little bit about some things.
Yeah, we just talked about how, like, he fought through it, some techniques that I could use to help myself fight through it and help help my mental health on how to, like, go through it all. And
yeah, you know. And that's a cool thing to see because Movember does a great job, again, of making you feel a part of the community. So you're able to make a connection with somebody through Movember where they're able to help you to have a different mindset about it, maybe a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to thank you, Coach Capeless and Hunter, for helping me with understanding Movember a little bit and giving our community a little bit of a talk today. This was the interview, and we will see you on the other side of Up on the Conic.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Multimedia Talks, where we discuss what goes on in multimedia and pull back the curtain on how our shows are made.
All right. Welcome to Multimedia Talks. I'm here joined by Dalton and Avery. Introduce yourselves.
Bonjour.
So, as I think the three of us know, as of last Wednesday, we produced the last episode of Morning Drive for this school year.
Correct. Yep.
So, considering that the three of us have played a pretty major role in the production
the carpools go crazy.
Shows, they in fact do. Thank you, Dalton, for all the rides you've been able to give us.
Thank you. Shout out Dalton's dad.
Yeah.
Shout out my dad.
Yeah, shout out Dalton's dad. I want to ask you guys a few questions on what your opinions are on the process, what it was like for us, and what we're going to be doing from here. Because I know we've been thinking about doing more live shows, even taking the Thunder Report and turning that into a live show. So might as well start with that. What are your guys' thoughts on taking the Thunder Report and turning it from a, what is it, live to tape production and turning it to a fully live production that goes out to the entire city of Pittsfield on a Friday morning?
All I'll say is I'm prepared. I can do that. That feels something I could very easily take on. I do the Thunder Report as easily as I breathe at this point.
Yeah.
So I could very easily do that, and I feel like I would have a lot of fun doing it. It'd make doing the Thunder Report feel less cookie cutter, I feel. It'd make it feel way more fun and enjoyable.
It would have like that good level of stress that something similar to a Morning Drive had, but I think
sort of
a little more toned down.
Yeah.
I would say definitely more toned down because we're going from an hour-long show to less than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But what do you think about that, Dalton?
I like the idea. It seems fun, like Avery said, but it also does seem a bit stressful because, as the both of you know,
you have the most stressful job.
Our studio doesn't like me.
The entire control room just hates you.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, aside from that, though, I kind of agreeing with what Chiquette and Jume say about us. We are kind of like a well-oiled machine.
Yeah.
And I think a live version of the Thunder Report would be no problem to us as long as we don't have any technical issues.
You need Kira back. For us to do it, we need Kira back. That maybe that's the best way of putting it.
I don't know. I don't know if we would.
I mean, maybe.
I don't want to sound rude, but, like, we don't need Kira back.
Well, like, I know what you mean.
I would have much better peace of mind if Kira was back for something like that.
I mean, I guess that makes sense.
If that was, like, her daily thing, like, she comes in on Fridays to do that with us, and then she also gets to hang out
but what would she do is the real question.
Probably, if you want to keep doing anchoring, she could do sound. And then if she wants to go back to doing anchoring specifically for the live portions, I'm fine with that.
I mean, yeah.
And that frees up your ability to do sound.
We've both done the same things. But, I mean, I think considering our crew, because I was kind of talking about this before, the idea of letting the ninth graders do the taped version that then goes up on YouTube and then we do the live version, just because we have a little more experience with, one, working with live shows, two, making the Thunder Report, so those two skills just combine. I think they would combine really well, especially for our crew.
I don't want to deny them the chance to work at a live Thunder Report, but I don't know if they're ready.
Yeah, but, like, I would say for the first few that we do, because we're probably not going to start doing this until probably a good way through senior year.
Yeah.
So I think
us doing the first few, at least, gives them the chance to level up, and they're making of a taped one. Until they eventually get to the point where they're like, I believe we could do a live one. I think we can do that. It's like once they reach where we were in like sophomore year with making the Thunder Report, I think that's when they'll be set to make a live one. But going back to the Morning Drive, I want to ask, how has Morning Drive been for you guys over the past almost 2 years now?
It's been some of the better things that I think we do in this shop. I really enjoy doing it, even if I have to skip breakfast.
Yeah.
It's fun. It's enjoyable. Usually I listen to a good topic of conversation. It is actually kind of really funny to sort of know exactly what Bill's going to say when he's going to say it because of how long we've done it. It's like, this is the part where he tells the story about the student who was going into welding so that they could pay for a nursing degree. Or, this is the part where he says, no way. Or this is the old Dakota.
Oh, my God, yeah.
It's like, I know what's going to happen. We have stims
at this point for Morning Drive.
He's a great guy. So it's just, he's a great person to work with.
Yeah, he's a great guy to work with. And, like, he's just a great guy in general. He's done so much for our community. He's done so much for us.
Yes.
Giving us the opportunity for the past 2 years now to work in a live production. Like, this man is retired.
Coming out of his retirement just to do this with us.
He is retired, and, like, I hate to say it, but, like, he's not in good health. And he still, through all of that, he still shows up for us to do these shows, to give us the experience and to work with someone who's been in community, like who's been in this community doing this kind of stuff for so long, giving us the opportunity to make a live show with someone as locally like prolific as him. It is a huge honor to be able to work with Bill.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Yeah. How has it been for you, Dalton?
It's been good.
Despite its stresses and the sometimes big moments that we have, like the recent one where the TriCaster decided to shut down like 3 minutes before we went live. That was stressful.
But when our two shot went down in the middle of it.
Yeah. But I mean, we pushed through it. We got shows working, and I think over the past 2 years we have made some very, very good live shows.
Yeah.
And that is I think definitely a big part of that is having Bill there. He is a great personality. He's a great host of that kind of show and just gives us, I would say gives us the best opportunity possible to make a really good live show.
I would agree.
I am very glad that we've had the opportunity to work with him for the past 2 years and just kind of get to know who Bill is.
Yeah.
I think it's been
up here early, like every.
Yeah.
To like every other week, basically.
Yeah, just like and showing up for us, I think that like that's the biggest part. So kind of continuing with that, for you guys, what has been the most rewarding part of working with live productions hosted by someone as experienced and locally profound as Bill Sturgeon?
All right, I have an answer for this for once. Getting through all of the hiccups, because especially on my side, for some reason, everything hates me. And it's always like, screw you, we're gonna do nothing.
Everything's gonna die.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like camera two shutting down, the TriCaster just dying right before we go live. Getting over those hiccups has really helped me.
Yeah.
In this shop.
Yeah. You can kind of see it in like the way you handle problems since we started doing these live shows It's almost surgical.
Yeah.
You are very, very meticulous with how you're solving problems and even like going the extra steps to prevent problems like what we did for the last show where, okay, cam 2 might go down like it did the other time, so let's bring cam 4 down and then adjust that to make it look a little more like cam 2's than we have that. Or one of these mics might go down. Let's have an extra lavalier mic for in case that goes down. If something goes really wrong and we lose two mics, we have the handheld mic for someone to hold. But I think the way with how unpredictable live shows can be, I think that is a very good point that it has taught all of us problem-solving skills and not just ones that are, like, problem-solving skills that are just, like, solving math equations.
Yeah.
That's actual real-life problems that are, like, very stressful and need immediate attention. And we all have learned how to handle those with a pretty calm demeanor, knowing how to solve those problems, knowing what steps we need to take, and just pushing us forward in the right direction to make shows live or taped in the future.
Yeah. And it definitely makes things feel a lot less cookie cutter when, you know.
Yeah. When, like.
Stuff starts to go wrong.
Yeah. It's definitely a good learning experience. It is definitely really good for our learning because it forces us into the uncomfortable. It forces us into, well, what are we going to do mode?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we can do this. Like with camera two. It's like, oh God, camera two went down. Okay. Let's lower camera four and use that as a backup shot. That, I think, it teaches us how to be very resourceful with the materials we have that I think we wouldn't if we didn't do live productions like Morning Drive, and we wouldn't if Morning Drive just went smoothly every time and it started to become cookie cutter like the Thunder Report kind of was at first.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think, Avery?
It's a lesson in being prepared, usually.
Yeah.
A lot of the stress that I have surrounding Morning Drive has nothing to do when I'm in there. That's not the problem.
Yeah.
What's always
most
the problem
of the preparation
is going, how do, from a director's point of view, going like, how do I get everyone together so that all of this can get done and Morning Drive is prepared? Because earlier when we were doing it, we had a lot of like hiccups with that. It was a lot of, oh, it'll get done. And then we would just like kind of slip up and not really get it very well done. Or sometimes, I swear to God, we even didn't do the preparation. Like, it just didn't happen.
So yeah, I remember there were a couple times, mainly last year, last school year, where we would just forget to set up the studio for Morning Drive. But it has definitely taught us a little more responsibility in that, in that sense of making sure we have everything aligned and making sure we have everyone set and getting everything the way we want it.
Mm-hmm. So, like, yeah, working around that, working with the schedule, making sure everything's good definitely would be my answer.
Yeah. All right. So I'm going to kind of flip the script here a little. I do want to ask, aside from the obvious answer of orchestrating rides to get here early, what has been the biggest form of stress for you guys making these shows?
Well, I don't orchestrate the rides, so I'm fine. Thank you,
Dalton. Yeah, well, aside from trying to, like, get here early and, like, making sure people have rides, making sure we're able to set things up early, like, what has been the biggest, I don't want to say drawback, but the biggest,
like, stress?
Yeah, the biggest stress, the biggest thing that weighs on your shoulders when we know that we have to do a Morning Drive, like, this week.
Getting good sleep and not zoning out.
That?
Easy answer.
And the fact that it's live.
It's live.
Yeah.
So I cannot.
If I mess up on something, there's
we
no,
can't go
oh,
back.
Cut,
yeah.
Yeah.
Let's retry that. No, this is live.
Crap.
It's done. Yeah.
Every
it's
mistake is like,
that.
It's a weird comparison, but it's like playing a turn-based game with no healer. It's like,
yeah,
you don't really have that, oh, I can just fix it button.
Yeah.
You have to actively avoid making
production.
The mistakes. You cannot fix the mistakes. You have to avoid them entirely.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that, it's just there.
Yeah. It's a matter of prevention, not a matter of like substitution or solution.
Exactly. So you kind of just gotta be like, oh, don't make this mistake or don't do this here. And like, I'm always a perfectionist. So it's like
when I'm working
with you on like camera angles, it's always like, oh, okay, Dalton, I want you to switch here and I want it to be this and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you're playing it smarter. I'm playing more riskier. So we kind of have to work together and find that middle ground of when to switch the cameras properly and when to do this and when to do that. Because there have been many times where I go, oh, it'd be so good to change this shot right here. And you don't switch it. And you're right. Because like, the guest will talk for like one quick thing and it'll feel like they're going to go into a big speech. And then they just don't. They just don't. And then Bill goes back to talking and it's like, it can ruin the camera angle. So you're good at like finding those moments where
you're a lot more methodical.
Yes.
Like,
with,
I have to
happen.
Like listen closely to like how everything's going. And over the past like year and a half, basically,
you've gotten really good at listening and seeing
like,
if
knowing
people are
gonna
go on.
They're going to go on this big rant or, oh, this is going to be like a 5-second answer.
Yeah. This
and
is going to be
so
pretty quick.
Sometimes, no offense, Avery, I just drown you out.
That's fair. Because it does sound like they're going to go on a big spiel and then they just don't. They're just So then my great, when I was a kid, I had this great story about blah, 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 blah. And then they just, like, you expect them to be, like, talk about
for,
how,
like, 5 full minutes and they're done for, and they're done in, like, 30
and they
seconds.
Go, like, and anyway, and then I didn't do that.
Yeah.
And then Bill goes, well, isn't that great? And then they move on to
the
next part.
And
I'm like,
it
come on, bro.
The thing, I would say the difference between the two of you is you're a lot more methodical and you make sure your camera angles matter and you make sure when you're switching matters. I think the difference is you're more spontaneous and you want to get, like, the best You want to
exactly.
Have
and
all
sometimes
the action
I am right.
In one frame at once.
Like, sometimes it can go either way. It's not like I'm stupid and I'm trying to jump the gun too quick. Sometimes Dalton can miss an angle because he's, like, being very methodical about that. So it's very – it's something I've noticed in general. Like, I work with a lot of people who tend to be very, like, cautious and very –
Yeah, like, I think the best combo is someone who is cautious and someone who throws caution a little more to the wind when
I'm kind of like
when doing something.
I
like
want to get the best shot I can.
Yeah,
and sometimes that's don't go to camp three.
Yeah,
don't go to camp one. Don't go to camp three. Like a very quickly switch.
Getting
like,
the best shot you can the moment it presents itself.
Yeah.
Versus waiting for the best moments and then finally when the time is right,
executing,
changing that camera angle and it ends up perfect. Mm-hmm. You two are a perfect storm.
Yes.
It's a perfect combination of the both of you.
He is the clouds, I am the thunder.
Yeah, that is actually a really good way to put it.
I mean, I usually try and wait for, like, whoever I'm on, I wait for the other person to start talking, then I, like, try and switch as quick as possible.
Yeah, but you wait a lot more carefully. I would say, like,
I'm a lot more cautious. Avery's like, switch the camera!
Yeah.
Switch the camera.
The difference between, like, this is gonna be kind of a weird thing at first, but the way you act with camera switches is like a pack of hyenas. You're like a tiger. Because hang on, hear me out. Let me explain myself.
Because
you lie in wait and you wait for the perfect opportunity to then go in and do the thing. You, on the other hand, are kind of more like...
I'd say it's actually more accurate to say he's the hyena and I'm the lion. Like, I'm so ready to just go and do the thing. And he lies in wait, waiting for the moment to strike. Because I feel
he's the lion, I'm the monkey.
That is true, yeah. That is true, yeah.
Sure, whatever. Sure, whatever you say, buddy. All right, Grandpa, let's get you back to bed.
Aww.
I say as the oldest person in this room.
That is true.
Yeah. All right. Just some bit of a lightning round question. Do you hope we continue to do more live shows in the future?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If I can kind of expand on that, what live shows do you hope we kind of transition into? Do you hope we do more morning drives? Do you hope we switch over to the Thunderport, or is there something different that you hope we kind of do?
I want
to
do something different. I want to do something new.
Something a little different. Like, Chiquette's always talking about, like, this morning drive-esque show that he's trying to bring up with WWR, where it's, like, in 10, like, at 10 in the afternoon, in the morning, instead of, you know, 6 in the morning.
Yeah, makes it a lot easier for us to schedule that, but...
Or, like, 8, 7, whatever.
Yeah.
Early in the morning.
Yeah.
A part of me would love to kind of host my own show, though, at the same time, and maybe give
a
spin.
I think that'd be... That'd be really fun. I mean, Chiquette's been talking forever about, like, the possibility of doing, like, a late show.
Yeah, I would
love to do
that.
Like, a late night show that goes up, like, later in the evening that we
do,
like, weekly or monthly or something like that. I think that'd be a really cool idea to kind of expand out more from what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like a lot of what we do kind of takes place early in the morning, so some people might miss that.
Yeah.
But then if we make, like, a late-night show, some people that missed early mornings, because, I mean, my mother's one of those people. She doesn't wake up early enough to see the shows live. Like, even if we did one at 9:30, she's usually waking up 10:30, 11 o'clock. So it's a lot harder for some people to wake up early enough to see them live, or maybe some people just don't know where they are. So it makes it a little easier if we have a lot more times that were available, like the podcast going up 6 p.m., the Thunder Report Friday mornings, and like we'd sprinkle in some online content throughout.
Yeah.
But I think definitely carrying through a lot of different times works well for us. So for my last question, are live shows something you would want to work with in the future, past high school? Like, maybe in college or in the actual workforce as a host, a guest, or maybe what we've been doing kind of continuing as a producer or a member of a production team.
I'll let you. Do you want to go first, Dalton? Because I have a very concise... I have an answer that I know I want, but I might go on for a little bit longer.
All right. Then I'm going to take the small bit of time that I have. I would say maybe. Like, I don't exactly know if I can, like, really look into my future and see still being, like, a tech director or something like that. My, like, kind of dream job, I think I brought this up this week and a couple times before, but, like, my dream job is to be, like, a bartender and maybe, like, a freelance editor on the side. So I don't really...
Yeah. I do feel like you're really good with media, and I do think it would suck to leave that behind, but, like, obviously follow your dreams.
Yeah. That's kind of why I want to be, like, an editor as well.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for me, I love me a good old concert. So to do sound or to do some form of...
Officiating a concert.
Yes. I just went to Miku Expo.
Concert,
it was great.
Concert work does sound like a lot of fun to do.
It sounds really hard, but it sounds a lot of fun.
It sounds very hard to orchestrate, but I mean, kind of similar to our morning drives, they're hard to officiate and they're hard to do, but they are very rewarding to do. Mm-hmm. Like, they're very rewarding to get done.
The cheers, I would love to do sound for a rock show.
The spotlight,
show.
The cheers, everything that goes on all at once.
But I love it.
Like, that form of ecstasy, I don't think that can be beat.
I would love to do sound for Miku. That'd be awesome. That would be awesome. That was crazy, though. Like, their band was insane. I would love to do that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for answering my questions and letting me pick your brain on our experience, our collective experience with Morning Drive. Now we will be moving on to Media Mayhem.
This is the moment you've all been waiting for. Media Mayhem!
All right. We are back once again, this time a little bit different. A little bit different of a... Rather than just kind of talking about various media, we're doing one big piece.
One media.
Yeah, on one media. Who you can't see, but he has a piece of that media staring at the microphone. Yeah. So, some of you may know, The Amazing Digital Circus, the last act, releases in theaters on June 4th and on YouTube 2 weeks later on June 19th. So, today, we're going to do a recap of all the episodes that have been released so far, starting with the pilot, released in October of 2023.
Spoilers, obviously.
Yes, yes, definitely. Big spoilers for The Amazing Digital Circus. If you haven't seen this and you want to, go see it. And come back to this later, because this will be on WWR's website. So if you're waiting to see it and then you see this, go do that first. But yeah, we're going to start with the pilot episode that was released in October of 2023. And we're going to end with episode 8, which released on March 20th, 2026. So we got about 2.5 years worth of digital circus to get to. So we might as well jump right in. We're going to start with the pilot. Now, the pilot starts as a... I would argue to say it kind of begins as, like the beginning of, like, an old kid's cartoon.
Yeah.
Kind of, like, that's similar. It has this nice jingle. You see all the characters. You meet the Ringmaster Kane. But the main thing that we're concerned about is the random woman who just suddenly shows up.
Pomni.
We don't learn that until later.
Pomni.
But, yeah, a woman becomes trapped in a circus-themed virtual reality game after putting on a weird headset. And she meets the aforementioned AI ringmaster of this colorful digital circus. Oh, my God. Name drop. Yeah. But, yeah. So, she meets Kane. And with the help of him through his little lottery system, she takes on the name Pomni after almost getting...
What do you think of...
Yeah.
You're right, what do you terrible. Think of... Let's try again.
And then Pomni.
What do you think of Pomni?
So, yeah. This newly named Pomni... meets the other 5 humans that are now, well, that have been trapped in this digital land along with her now. We have a lanky purple rabbit named Jax. I don't know why that's so funny to you. He is lanky, he is purple, and he is a rabbit, and his name is Jax.
I didn't do anything.
You went to laugh. And then we got this guy across from me, Kinger, who is a mentally insane chess piece.
Oh, hi, Pomni.
No, I'm not joking.
Oh, hi, Pomni.
Yeah, he does that a lot. Anyways, we have a ragdoll character named Ragatha, who I hate.
What did she do?
I just hate that she doesn't have any character development.
That's not her fault.
She gets like 2 minutes of character development episode 6, and that's it.
I know.
Anyways.
That's not her fault.
Then we get basically a sentient comedy and tragedy mask with a body made of ribbons named Gangle, and a weird collection of various bits and pieces from a children's toy box named Zubal, who is a sailor mouth. But... What? It's true, is it not?
No, you're not wrong.
She literally gets the award for that.
Yeah.
But either way, Kane sends the humans, including the now integrated Pomni, on an in-house adventure, basically just meaning inside the main tent of the circus, that he called Gather the Gloinks, which were basically small little geometric shapes that were just causing havoc and being mischievous. They then proceeded to tear Zool to pieces.
Lovely way to open up a show.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, It's probably better her than anybody else because she's just like a toy box character.
Yeah.
Her whole gimmick is removable limbs.
Yeah.
So yeah, they just kind of like divide her up into pieces and they carry her into a little hole to a big cavern, which houses the Glunk Queen. Which is this thing. I don't know what to describe it as. It's like a slug, yeah. Kind of.
Like a slug, it's like an alligator jaw.
Yeah.
That's the best way I could describe it.
It's like Absolute Killer Crocs? I mean, it kind of is.
Yeah.
Like with like the big jaw. But either way, meanwhile, while Kinger and Gengel are sent to go find Zubul, Jax.
Baby and hoo ha.
Yep.
Sorry.
Jax, Ragatha, and Pomni go to check up on the sixth human who wasn't in the main area of the tent at the time that Pomni showed up, named Kofmo, to find that he is dead, for lack of a better word. He has abstracted.
Kofmo, which some kind of Kofmosis and abstracted.
Yep, he sure did, which basically, for those of you who don't know, abstraction is basically death in the digital circus, but it basically, what it actually is insanity, which then messes with your code, because these are digital avatars and they're not actual just people in there. They are avatars based on people's minds. So abstraction is basically just losing their mind and then therefore corrupting the code, which then corrupts the avatar into this weird... I mean, I guess the best way to put it is like a giraffe shape.
It is about, like, I would say the size of a giraffe.
Well, I don't know about size, but like...
It's like giraffe-shaped because it's like...
Yeah, it's at least giraffe
and a really long neck.
Yes. But then Kofmo, who is insane, attacks Ragatha and Pomni after Jax just dips. Because he realizes what's going on. He's not a bum. He's just smart. He's just smart. No.
He's a loser.
But the abstraction attacks Ragatha, who then starts to weirdly glitch out herself. And then Pomni just leaves.
He's a bum.
No. Pomni leaves, but for the sake of going to find Kane to fix the problem. As she is searching, she finds an exit door, which then leads her into a very large, probably infinite, labyrinth of doors and hallways in the office of an abandoned building called CNA. We'll learn what that means later. But eventually, she goes through enough doors and eventually spills out into the void, which is, I would assume, an out-of-bounds area. That's kind of what it is in terms of the show. But after she gets there, Kane gets a notification on his wacky watch, which he only has in this one episode and never again. I'm pretty sure, at least. But he gets a notification that a player is in the void, and then he goes to get Pomni, bringing her back to the tent. And from there, he learns of Kofmo's abstraction. Just kind of learns that Kofmo is gone. And sends him into the cellar, which is where all the other abstractions go. By the time that Pomni gets back, Kinger, Gengel, and Jax, who left Ragatha and Pomni before he went to go join them, he joins them for the retrieval of Zubul from the Glunk Queen, which means the adventure is completed. It's done. Pop the confetti and woo!
Yay!
Yeah. And the reward is a digital meal cooked by Bubble, Kane's assistant AI.
All the love he can legally give.
And then Pomni goes through an existential crisis as she grapples with the fact that the digital circus is her new home. So, from there, that is the end of episode 1. We then move on to episode 2. I think it's called Candy Carrier Chaos, I believe is the actual title. Yeah, Candy Carrier Chaos. So, we open with the gang all meeting up, and then Kane sends them on a new adventure, which I believe was by the same name, which I think is where the title comes from. It was also Candy Carrier Chaos. The premise is that Candy Canyon Kingdom needs help from a group of gummy alligator bandits who stole that town's life source, which was maple syrup. They have a giant, like, war rig tanker full of maple syrup. So the gang is tasked with taking down the bandits and getting the maple syrup back in their own little war rig. This leads to a very long scuffle that eventually ends with the bandit's truck falling off the side of a cliff and then clipping through the map. So, while this is happening, Jax is just being malicious. He's just kind of being a jerk. But, either way, Pomni and the leader, of the bandits, Gummy Goo, they end up falling underneath the map, where Gummy Goo also has an existential crisis. This show is full of those. But Gummy Goo basically learns the fact that he is an NPC and that he isn't real.
He does not exist.
Basically learns that he is not who he thinks he is. He's just some thing that is added to adventures to flesh out the adventures themselves and keep the humans sane. So he kind of goes a little cuckoo as he realizes what he is and what he isn't. But after he's done moping, like a bum, Pomni convinces him to help her get back up to the surface with the promise that she will help Gummy Goo get back to the circus. Or she will take him back to the circus with her. So they end up glitching back through the top of the map and they end up back where they should be. So they meet up with the rest of the gang. And Jax, of course, because this is early show Jax, so he just has to be as mean as possible, leaves the gate open for this character, the Fudge, to just absolutely commit genocide. Mm-hmm. To just completely lay waste to the kingdom. But either way, the adventure's complete. Everyone heads back to the circus. And then Kane murks Gummy Goo.
Yep.
Yeah, just
like one of these guys got through.
Yeah, just bang. Gummy confetti. Goo gone. Yeah, he explodes into a ball of confetti. Yeah, pop the confetti.
Adventure's done. Pop the confetti.
Gummy Goo is gone. But yeah, Kane's reasoning for that was that if he can't discern who is human and who isn't, who knows what could happen. We later learn that this is a lie. One of many.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yep. But yeah, that's the end of episode 2. Pomni is now trauma. She's traumatized.
She is trauma.
Yep. Jane trauma over here. But she's now just absolutely traumatized by the fact that Kane just murked someone in front of her with not even a second thought.
Yep.
And that is where episode 2 ends.
No, it ends with Kothma's funeral.
Oh, yes, right. Right, it ends with the funeral of Kothma where all the characters assumingly give heartfelt speeches. We can't hear it at the time because the audio is, or at least their voices are muted as some somber music plays.
Yeah.
But we assume they probably have some somber speeches about Kothma and what he did for the circus. Episode 3 opens with the gang surrounding Pomni as she tries to find out what happens when she holds her breath, because supposedly something different happens for everyone. Kinger starts glowing, Gangle's mask starts spinning, Zubal's limbs turn straight. Make your joke.
And Zubal turns straight.
There you go. Yeah, Zubal's limbs go fully straight, and Pomni just starts changing colors.
And Ragatha's hair stands
up. Oh, right, yeah. I forgot she exists. What do you know? Well, maybe if she had some better freaking character development, I'd remember she exists. Fault. It is her fault.
How is that her fault?
She should just be a better character. I hate Ragatha.
We know.
But, so, Pomni just starts changing colors. I think she, it's like blue, green, orange, red, and then I think it just cycles back through there. She basically just turns into an RGB keyboard whenever she holds her breath. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong.
Exactly. But from there, Kane sends them on a mission to discover the horrors within the Mildenhall Manor, the mystery of the Mildenhall Manor. So once they get inside, there are two doors. There's one that's not scary, and there's one that's very scary. That one was for Zubal. The normal one was for everybody else. You'll see why. So Jax takes Gangle's comedy mask and throws it down the super scary door, which then causes Kinger to
take Pomni's eye, and then also throw that down the...
No, he jumps in, and he's still got a hold of Pomni's eye, and then Pomni falls in after him.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, because he was like... I think, like, she got scared, and because of her avatar's wacky physics, her eyes popped out.
Yeah.
And then Kinger was trying to, like, put them back in, and then he jumps to the door, but he's still holding her eye, so then she gets dragged in and falls down into the... I think it's, like, the basement of the manor.
Yeah.
Behind him. Then they just find a demon. Or do they? They hear the story of Baron Theodore Mildenhall, I think is his name.
Yes.
But basically he tells a story of hunting down this weird, mysterious, abstract creature that is nothing like anything he's seen before. And as Kinger and Pomni keep looking deeper, they find it. And it's just a severed head screaming at them. Yeah. So they temporarily evade it by going down one of the,
It was like a laundry chute.
I don't remember what they're called. They're the things that, old mansions...
It's like a pulley system.
Basically. Yeah, it's the old elevator system that old mansions had for, like, maids to go between floors. I cannot remember what they're called. But basically, they use one of those. They tend to go up, but they actually go down instead, which Kinger screams about. Yeah. Because he thinks it's going to go up, and then it doesn't. So they end up in the bottom level of the manor, which I think was like a wine cellar of sorts.
Yeah.
Of some kind. And that is where they find Baron's body, holding a loaded shotgun in preparation for the monster. Which, I think, with the way his body is and the way that, and the fact that the shotgun's still loaded, I'm assuming either
I think he's
it
starved
ambushed
to death.
Him, or he just starved to death afterwards. Like, in waiting, because he was hiding from his family, and his family, he was like starting to lose his grip on reality because he was so obsessed over finding this monster.
Yeah.
So, Pomni grabs the shotgun from Baron, who turns alive int.
Please don't come alive.
Okay, I won't. I won't. Yeah, that is what happens. The body just randomly just goes, okay, I won't. But yeah. So, Kinger gets the shotgun, and he's kind of just standing guard waiting for it. And then they find the body of the creature, which turns out to be two separate entities because the head controls one part of it and the body is separately controlled. So Kinger shoots the body, then turns and shoots the head. And then he says the cursed words that you never want to hear in any sort of horror flick. That wasn't so bad. Then they get dragged to hell.
That is not an exaggeration.
That's not an exaggeration.
They get dragged to hell
because the creature turned out to be one of God's angels. And anyone who harmed it would be dragged to hell. So they were dragged to hell. In there, they see a cord or a hallway of sorts, and Pomni tries to run down it. And then, while trying to do that, she gets possessed by, I'd assume, one of the souls of the damned.
Yeah.
So she reminds Kinger of his abstracted wife, Queenie.
How's the wife, Kinger?
Yeah, and then after Kinger expels the spirit, he starts to give some backstory on himself. He did 7 years of computer science and then starts to talk about his wife and why the dark makes him a little more sane, which we learn in this episode that the dark makes him a little more sane. And he's not just like this crazy guy. He actually has a sane side, and it's when he's in the dark. And he explains that it's because his abstracted wife, before she went into the cellar, he got one more moment with her that was in the dark inside his pillow fort. So, after that, Kinger gets the idea that maybe if they hold their breath while they're going through the corridor, they won't get possessed. Because the tape that Baron, one of the tapes that Baron left said that they would breathe their final breath in hell. So, he theorizes that, well, if we just don't breathe, maybe we won't get possessed and maybe we can escape. It turns out to work. Which, this is important. Because Cain made that room specifically for Zubal, who, if you remember, her limbs turn straight when she holds her breath, meaning she can't walk.
She might be able to waddle.
Well, like, maybe, but she'd probably, like, fall over.
Yeah.
But basically, Cain's goal was to trap Zubal in there for at least a very long time. So that's something. It's kind of like the first sight we
Zubal
see.
Zubal also doesn't have a mouth. So, like...
Actually, wait, yeah.
How would Zubal breathe? Like,
good question.
I don't know.
That's too deep of a question to get into. We don't have the time for that. We don't have the time to theorize. But yeah, that brings us to the end of episode 3, where they all meet back up and Kinger forgets Gangle's mask. That's just great. Great job,
just
Kinger.
Just an FYI, the unscary door was just a tea party.
Yeah, with Baron's wife.
Yeah.
Who was a ghost at this point. Because I think the manor had probably been abandoned for like 100 years or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah. So that is the end of episode 3. And that is, I think, where we're going to leave this off for now. So we'll get back to that at some point. Hopefully we'll be able to get through all this before the Amazing Digital Circus, the last act, releases again in theaters June 4th. On YouTube 2 weeks later on June 19th. All right. And that is going to do it for this week's episode of Up on Taconic. I'd like to thank Avery, Dalton, and everyone who was involved with today's episode. For more from us here at Taconic TV, check out the Thunder Report on the Taconic TV YouTube channel every Friday. We hope you all have a wonderful evening, and we'll see you next time on Up on Taconic.